Welcome to the Hereditary Angioedema edition of Rare Disease Advisor's Rare Care Podcast, offering unique perspectives from researchers, clinicians, and influencers from the HAE community.
Hello, and welcome to the Rare Care Podcast. This is Larry Luxner, Senior Correspondent for Rare Disease Advisor. We're at the 2024 American College of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology Conference in Boston. Our guest is Dr. Timothy Craig, a tenured professor of medicine, pediatrics, and biomedical sciences at Penn State University in Hershey. Dr. Craig is also a senior advisor for Vinmec International Hospital in Hanoi, Vietnam. He's specialized in hereditary angioedema, or HAE, as well as alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency for the last 30 years. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. The pleasure's mine.
So your presentation at today's panel was titled HAE, Recognizing It Early Can Save a Life. Can you expand on that? Just give us a general overview of why that is the case.
Yeah. So the case is a lot of people who have HAE don't know they have it. And what we talked about was the studies that were done in Europe by Dr. Bork, showing that there's a high mortality rate in those people because of asphyxia of the throat. So we reviewed the data from Dr. Comrade Bork, which showed that there was a high death rate associated with asphyxia in people from families that were known to have HAE, but these were people in those family groups that didn't have the knowledge of HAE. And so the idea is to make sure you actually identify people's groups, families, and test them. Also make sure you test people early in life, because it's uncommon, but a baby could have asphyxia from an upper airway swelling. And also to make sure they have rescue medication once they're diagnosed, and to make sure you explore the importance of short-term prophylaxis and avoidance of triggers in those people.
You mentioned that only 75% of patients who have hereditary angioedema also have a family history. 25% are de novo mutations.
That's correct. That's right. So, and plus you figure, so if you're just doing a family history as you're screening, you'll miss that 25%, and probably others too, because people move around. You know, people move to Europe or to California from New York, and they don't know really what their brothers and sisters are doing. Plus, every once in a while, HAE skips a generation. The genetic abnormality is there, the protein abnormality is there, but they don't have symptoms. And I've seen that not infrequently. So, you know, again, it's very important to get a family history, but you're not going to exclude hereditary angioedema if, in fact, they don't have a family history, if you suspect that's what they have.
That makes sense. Is this something that newborns are screened for generally?
This is not part of the newborn screening, which is interesting. You know, you almost wonder if it should. But I feel that anybody who's born to a family with HAE really should have newborn screening. Not that it's the foot stab that is done automatically, but to have it done, it is biochemical tests that can help diagnose a baby at a very early age. And if you really need to and that is confusing, you can get genetic testing on
it. Are you
as
referring
well.
To a heel prick?
Yes, the heel prick is usually used for, you know, the state mandated testing, but hereditary angioedema is not part of that.
I understand. You also mentioned that you try to diagnose, to do your best to diagnose in the first year of life, because this is extremely important later on to get tested early. Can you tell me why that is?
Yeah, so even though most people are diagnosed within the first two decades of life, and the average symptom is usually around 10 years of age, in reality, people much younger than that can have an attack. And there's some worries about that. Not only could they theoretically, as I mentioned, have asphyxia as their first attack, which would be unlikely but possible, but also often they'll get abdominal pain and go to the emergency room. And if they don't have the diagnosis established, they often get CAT scans and then maybe even a surgical procedure, because radiologists aren't used to this disease either. And so they often miss the diagnosis of hereditary angioedema. And then people go on to get a surgery they really don't need. So If you had them diagnosed and they had therapy, when they went to the emergency room, hopefully the ER physician, the emergency room physician, would give the medication. And by the time a surgeon got out of bed, their symptoms would already be starting to improve.
You said that, interestingly enough, a lot of patients think they have hives when in fact they don't.
Yeah, so there's a prodrome, we call it. That is, before they get the swelling, there's some people who get erythema marginatum. And this can look just like a hive, but it doesn't itch, and that's the distinction. But it can look like it. This rash is more serpiginous than a hive, but sometimes hives can have that serpiginous look too. So when I see this, you know, it makes me think about HAE, but if someone is not educated on hives versus this erythema marginatum, they might miss it and think that they're having hives and would lead you to maybe not diagnose that patient or not do the testing on that patient.
Patients with HAE do not experience itching, correct?
They usually don't experience itching, that's right. And they usually don't get hives. 20% of people in their life get urticaria. So, you know, it's not unlikely that maybe 20% of HAE patients might have urticaria as well. So usually we think about HAE as not associated with urticaria, but if you think everything else looks like HAE, then you should probably get to test it on that individual.
And when should pediatrics be tested?
So I think first year of life for sure, but I would say the first month of life would be best.
I see. And you also mentioned that that patients should always have two doses on demand at all times. Why is that?
Yeah, so when I diagnose even a young baby who might never have had an attack yet, I still make sure they have two doses of rescue medication, and usually medication that could also be used for short-term prophylaxis. And the reason why that's important is that in about 10% of cases, some of the medications used for rescue, for what we call on-demand therapy, are not effective and they need a second dose. So some people think that requirement to have two doses is because, well, they could use the medication today, and what happens for their next attack while they're waiting for the medication to come in the mail.
But that's not the case.
That's partially the case, but the main thing, in 10% of attacks, you might need a second dose. So that's why I say everybody should have two doses.
Got it. And you mentioned also some common triggers that precipitate an attack, including emotional, physical stress, surgery, even dental work.
Yeah. So surgery, dental work, medical procedures, trauma. But yeah, you know, it's interesting that most people don't remember a trigger for their attack. So it's probably about 40% of people that remember a trigger for the attack. The other 60% of the attack just occurs spontaneous. But it's educating the patients about those triggers and making sure they have short-term prophylaxis before those triggers, especially surgery, dental work, and medical procedures, is very, very important. When I say dental work, though, you know, it's more so extractions or something that has a lot of trauma to the oral mucosa, probably not cleaning your teeth.
Right, so we're not talking about a regular dental hygienist doing a cleaning and x-rays.
Yeah, that's some of my colleagues feel that can be a trigger, and it probably can be. But usually I have that in those cases, people take two of their rescue medication, or maybe they might go on androgens for 5 days before and a few days after and not get an IV. But if they're going to get an extraction, I definitely will give them IV C1 inhibitor.
Okay, turning to your other disease specialty, alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, also known as AATD. This disease doesn't seem to have too much in common with HAE. So why did you decide to specialize in these two seemingly unrelated illnesses?
Yeah, well, they both have the serpent protein, which is a suicide protein that destroys an elastase in the case of alpha-1 antitrypsin. So yeah, I figured since they're both serpent proteins and they're both orphan diseases, that it might be worth studying. Now, the thing with alpha-1 antitrypsin is that a lot of doctors, just like hereditary angioedema, have no knowledge base of it at all. So it just seemed like it was a good thing to bring to my community.
AATD is more common than HAE.
Much more, yeah. So in the United States, we think about maybe 6,000 to 10,000 HAE patients. In United States with alpha-1, we think about 110,000 who have severe alpha-1 deficiency.
Right. And you work closely with the Alpha One Foundation, correct?
That's right. Yes, I do. I have a center, a resource center from the Alpha One.
Not too long ago, you did a study, and it's called The Allergist's Role in Detection of Severe Alpha One Antitrypsin Deficiency. This was published in September of 2017, and it basically talks about why it's important to detect this disease early. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. So about 30% of people who have Alpha One present to allergists when they start having symptoms. And unfortunately, allergists are not very well educated in the disease. And so I actually see it, my mission as being educate an allergist so they know to screen for alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. Now, pulmonologists have much greater insight to the disease, but a lot of pulmonologists think they only test people because they feel that they can recognize an alpha-1 patient. And that's not true. Your chest x-ray can be normal, or it could be bronchiectasis, or it could be severe COPD of the upper part of the lung or the lower, or the combination of both. Even the CT scans can show that variability. The symptoms can be very variable and be very similar to asthma. So really the only way to recognize a disease and making sure you diagnose the disease is by getting the screen and done. And we say anybody who has obstructive lung disease that doesn't reverse to normal should get tested, and that includes asthmatics as well as people with COPD.
Very interesting. Alpha-1 is also kind of unusual in that it not only affects the lung but the liver as well. So it presents as a liver disease frequently.
Yeah. So a good portion of people have clinically significant liver disease, but not everybody. But it is a fair amount of people go on to get liver transplants. Hopefully, after liver transplant, the new liver will produce normal alpha-1 protein, which then will protect the lungs from then on. But, you know, right now, unfortunately, though we have treatment to prevent worsening of the lung function, which is augmentation with alpha protein, there is no treatment for the liver disease yet except for transplant. Now there is some investigation on removing that Z protein from the liver, so maybe to decrease the cirrhosis. But right now, you know, there's not much you can do other than conservative, like don't drink too much alcohol, don't take non-steroidals, don't get obese. You know, those are the only things you can really recommend. Oh, and hepatitis A and B vaccines.
And fortunately, it's a lot easier to get a liver transplant than a lung transplant.
Oh, yeah. Lungs are very difficult, and they're short-lived because they're exposed to the environment. So, you know, before getting a lung transplant, you want to make sure somebody has really very, very severe lung disease, because the lung's only going to last about 5 years. So you don't want to go through all that transplantation, all the surgery and so on, and have a lung that's only going to last 3 years, which might have been how long you lasted anyway. The other thing is it's not only the genetics of the person, but also the size of the chest. A little person can't get a big lung, and a big person can't get a little lung. So there's more variables there than there is with kidney and liver transplant.
That's something I didn't think of. We're just about out of time. Any final thoughts?
No. I think, you know, hopefully your doctors and the doctors who are listening to this would think about anybody who has obstructive lung disease that doesn't correct, who'll be testing for alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. And hopefully anybody who comes to you with angioedema and ACE inhibitors aren't the cause, and there's not a big hive into play with that person, that you'll be screening them for hereditary angioedema.
Thank you very much. We've been talking with Dr. Timothy Craig of Penn State University in Hershey. And this is Larry Luxner for Rare Disease Advisor. Thank you.
Be sure to follow the latest news, perspectives, and clinical resources on rare diseases at rarediseaseadvisor.com. Thank you for listening.